labels and terms. People, and now we're getting into the real meat, because this is what confuses people most. How do I know that my wine is dry? And believe me, it is frustrating. Nobody wants to spend money on a bottle of wine when they can't tell what it's going to taste like, because you don't want to run that risk. You know what you like, you know what you would like to drink, and yet you're supposed to buy Riesling and you can't tell. And the International Riesling Foundation have come up with this beautiful scale, but so few people use it, which is really idiotic because it would make life so much easier. But if the alcohol level really tells you a lot, anything up to 10% ABV is either really sweet or off dry. Anything around 11 is off dry to dry, depending where it's from. And anything at 12 or above really should be dry. And then, of course, you have the German wine lingo. It says trocken means dry. But in Germany, legally, trocken can mean up to 9 grams of sugar. But if you want to have 9 grams of sugar in your trocken, you must have at least 7 grams of acid. And that really is operative. And we get to this. There are separate slides on acid and sugar, because this is one of the key things to understand about Riesling. So trocken, usually people don't write it anymore if it's not really trocken. And there is really bloody bone dry Riesling these days with like 2-3 grams, especially in super ripe years like 17, 18, 19. There is no real reason to have residual sugar, unless you want to do it stylistically. And then we have the beautiful word Feinherb. The word Feinherb is not legally defined. So trocken, halbtrocken, lieblich und süß, they are defined terms in law. The term Feinherb isn't, but that is its beauty. And this is what I would describe as off dry. And depending on where your acid is, your sugar can be anywhere between 9 grams, 10 grams, 20 grams, even 20 grams can still taste fine herb if you have a killer acid. And so one of the things I want you to go away with today is understanding that if you ask for sugar, if you ask the winemaker, or if you look at a list of stats and you only look at sugar, you're only looking at half the picture, because the missing information is the acid. Okay, so let's move on. Sugar. The two chief sugars in grapes are glucose and fructose. And as grape juice ferments, so fermentation turns sugar into alcohol, turns juice and must into wine, yeasts prefer to metabolize glucose. So when you have residual sugar in Riesling, then this is fructose. And fructose is sweeter, comes across as sweeter and fresher than glucose. And it's actually, when you bite into an apple, the sweetness of an apple will be fructose. Whereas if you eat grapes, that'll mostly be glucose. And I mean table grapes, because they don't have that much fructose in them. But so in wine, we know that yeasts metabolize glucose first and then fructose. So when you have residual sugar, more likely than not, it's fructose. And you can have any level of sweetness. You can have really, really, really bone dry Riesling or lusciously sweet Riesling. And this is something that I have learned in Champagne, not in Germany. But it's a principle. Once you have understood it, it makes sense. So if I take a really ripe strawberry and I put 2 or 3 grains of crystallized sugar on it, caster sugar, not a lot of sugar, just a little bit, that sweetness acts as a flavor enhancer, not a sweetener. And if you've ever had the opportunity to taste the same champagne without dosage and with a little bit of dosage, you will know what I mean. The wine will still taste bone dry, but a tiny bit of sugar just gives that curve, that little bit of emphasis on the fruit. So sugar is an interesting thing. Not all sugar acts as a sweetener. In tiny amounts, sugar acts as a flavor enhancer, just like salt acts as a flavor enhancer, okay? And now acid. The two chief acids in wine are tartaric acid, which is proper to wine, doesn't exist anywhere else, and malic acid, which is apple acid. And these are the two acids that define the acidity of wine. And Riesling's freshness very often is due to sharp electric malic acid. And acid counters residual sugar and prevents it from being cloying, while sugar buffers the high acid and creates balance. So you can never look at sugar alone or at acid alone. And if you think why Germany is so often associated with sweet wines or residually sweet wines, it is because in the second half of the 20th century, there were such killer acids in Germany, like 20 grams per liter. Bloody hell, you need a bit of sugar, otherwise you can't drink it. Those days are gone, but this is how this reputation came about, because you needed sugar, because you had such horrendous acid. But if you look at sugar, you also need to look at acid. And if you look at acid, you need to look at sugar, because they inform each other. Now, this is not something I've made up. This is something that I compiled once as I was doing my MW studies, when somebody gave me a supermarket compendium of all the wines that were sold in the supermarket, which had all of their analytical data. And I looked at all the Italian Pinot Grigio they were selling. And the analytical data. And most Pinot Grigio had around 4.5 grams per liter of acid, okay? And if you have a wine that has just 4.5 grams per liter of acid, 4 grams of sugar already begin to cloy. However, Riesling, even in warm years, has at least 6 grams, if not 7 grams. So usually you have anywhere between 7.5 to 9 grams of acid in Riesling. And it's usually also malic acid, which is kind of more electric and sharper. And then, so if you had a Pinot Grigio at 4.5 grams of acid, and 4.5 grams of sugar, it would already taste cloying. Now take a Riesling, which has 9 grams of acid and 4.5 grams of sugar, that tastes dry. And if you have a Riesling with 9 grams of acid and 9 grams of sugar, that begins to taste fruity and a little softer, but it still tastes dryish. So, and if you then have from a cooler year or from some really high altitude vineyard, say a Mosel Riesling with 11 grams of acid, 30 grams of sugar will disappear. And this is, so you cannot never, never, ever look at sugar in isolation. You also must look at acid, because this is the key. Now, understanding the interaction between sweetness and acidity enables us to use Riesling in a way that no other wine can be used. And if there are any SOMs listening out, so whenever you have a sweet element in an otherwise savory dish, say you have a terrine, a meat terrine, and you have a bit of apple chutney on the side, that apple chutney will, in that otherwise completely savory dish, that touch of sweetness will absolutely echo the touch of sweetness in a dry Riesling. And once you understand what's going on there, and once you experiment a little bit, you can play and you can make food and wine pairings that are compelling and that very few other wines can pull off in the same way. I also wanted to touch upon this because this is what happens a lot. This somebody noses a glass of mature Riesling, and I've observed this so many times. you pour somebody a mature Riesling, say 5 years old, 10 years old, 20 years old, and Riesling ages like nothing else. This is one of the joys of Riesling, that it really, really ages and evolves. And not only the top Rieslings, even simple Rieslings age and bring you these gorgeous flavors. So if you like them, lay down your wine, lay down your Cabinet, not only your Auslese and your TBA. You know, there is joy to be had. And so if you show somebody a mature Riesling and they swirl the glass, they stick their nose in and they say, ah, petrol. However, not all mature aroma of Riesling is TDN, because this is what petrol, that petrol smell is 1,16-trimethyl-1,2-dihydronaphthalene. So no wonder we say TDN, because that's a bit of a tongue twister. Trimethyl dihydronaphthalene. Again, try saying this after a few glasses. That'll be fun. And so this is that petrol aroma. But there have been many, many, many studies that show that it actually isn't as prevalent in German Riesling as it, say, is in Alsace Riesling or in Australian Riesling. In Australian Riesling, you have it because you have far more intense sunshine. And what I talked about in those latitudes and the light, not the heat, that falls away in lots of Australia, because what is considered cool in Australia is nowhere near as cool as some parts of Germany are. And so we know that TDN is a result of sunlight on grape skins. And the grapes and the juice themselves don't have TDN, but TDN is something that is made from a carotenoid precursor that comes into the grape with sunlight. So if you expose your grapes to a lot of direct sunshine by leaf plucking, then you have possible flavor precursors for TDN. And also, if you have a fruiting zone in a normal trellis where all of your grapes are in the same space and you pluck leaves to expose them to sunlight, it's a very different story from, again, your single high stake in the Mosel, say, or in the Nahe, where you have grapes growing throughout different parts of the vine, at the bottom, in the middle, at the top, and they're usually shaded by leaves. So that also hinders the development of these precursors. And then we know that, for instance, Alsatian Riesling clones have a higher tendency to produce these precursors. But studies show that in German Riesling, TDN actually isn't such a big deal. And the interesting thing as well is that you can have both bound and free TDN in your wine. And if you have, say, Riesling, you buy a case of Riesling with 12 bottles and you open a bottle after 5 years, it might have a very different level of TDN after 10 years, because it dissipates and gets bound up again. And so TDN is this funny thing, but not all mature Riesling has TDN. And this is just another thing that, because it's a bugbear of mine when people say, you know, they smell this heady, gorgeous scent of mature Riesling, which to me is far more reminiscent of chamomile tincture and of dried herbs and of crushed yarrow. And they immediately say petrol when it isn't. So be careful and don't throw words around like petrol. And be happy that my sermon is now over and I haven't even mentioned the dreaded word minerality, and I shan't. So this was my last slide, or my penultimate slide, and I still have to say, Riesling cannot be easily categorized, and that is both its strength and its weakness. Its weakness because people are confused by it, and you can't blame them, because it is confusing and because it is so wide. You can't ever shove German Riesling into a neat little box. Doesn't work. It's you can't do that. Riesling grows across Germany, across 4 degrees of latitude. It is incredibly diverse. And then you also have, you know, like, is it barrel fermented or stainless steel fermented? Is it dry? Is it sweet or anything in between? Is it spontaneous yeast? Is it cultured yeast? Is it from Kuiper, from limestone, from sandstone, from rhyolite, from slate? You name it. It just, you know, like, it makes your head explode. It makes my head explode, but with pleasure. So Riesling defies easy categorization. It's endlessly diverse. And there are just three things I want to leave you with. Versatility, variety, and value. Because Riesling is still incredibly cheap for what it actually is. If you think how much money you pay for even a run-of-the-mill Bourgogne Rouge or Bourgogne Blanc, and then you think somebody sweats their ass off on a super steep slope in January doing the pruning, doing the tending, the harvesting with tiny yields, and then you only pay 20 quid for a bottle of Mosel Riesling, it should be a crime. So, but for us consumers, that's cause for joy because you have great value.